The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Hello, welcome to The Money Show. Friday evening here on The Money Show. So it means brutal biz quiz. It means some of the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been, as well as some pretty big chunky news stories on the day as well. The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Foresight on innovative payment solutions enables growth. The bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to the show this evening. Chris Griffith, the chief executive at Goldfields, is standing by. We'll catch up with Wayne Devenage this evening. I worry, because it's Halloween, that we've got the cancellation of e-tolls and the responsibility of then looking after the roads that were tolled previously gets handed over to the Gauteng government. They're going to have to do something in order to pay for those roads into the future. And there's not much money in the budget. Wayne Devenage on that one this evening. Then Stephen Steinfeld this evening, the Joburg foodie. It's World Champagne Day today. Where's the champagne, everyone? If it's World Champagne Day, there should be bubbles. There should be fizz. It's Friday night, after all. We're going to be talking about champagne ahead of the Absa Champagne Festival. That's coming up next Wednesday. We're broadcasting from that event next week. We're going to be abstemious, at least between 6 and 8, as we learn more about champagne. But we'll get the sort of beginner's guide, if you like, to champagne this evening on The Money Show before we play the Brutal Biz quiz and then into the best bits of The Money Show coming up between 7 and 8.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, Goldfields has got an uphill battle over the next 3 weeks, convincing its investors that it should buy a company in Canada called Yamana Gold. Biggest concern seems to be the price that Goldfields has put on the table for Yamana Gold. It's a $6.7 billion deal. It's a deal to be done in Goldfields shares. Chris Griffith is the chief executive of Goldfields on the line to us this evening from Johannesburg. Why is it that this Yamana Gold is so attractive to Goldfields, in your view, Chris Griffith?
Hi, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. Bruce, I mean, they've got quality assets. So they've got quality assets in jurisdictions that we want to get into, like Canada. They've got quality assets where we operate in South America. And they've got a great pipeline of future projects and exploration that we think will be a great fit with Goldfields' existing assets. So this is a combination of two companies that works well with our growth and cash flow in the short term, and they provide longer term projects and replacement for when we start declining production. So I think it's a combination that works really well in jurisdictions that we work in and want to get into. That's the reason, Bruce.
Why is the market unconvinced? I mean, we saw your share price take a hefty knock the moment you announced the deal. We're seeing a growing number of shareholders coming out and saying this deal just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, Bruce, initially I think it was to be expected because this is a big deal and it was, unexpected. And the market doesn't really know. So Goldfields shareholders didn't really know Yamana and likewise Yamana shareholders for Goldfields. I think over time, most shareholders have become familiar with the strategy and familiar with the assets, and we've got a lot more support. And recently, when we issued our circular, is when for the first time we could show independent valuation that supports the value that we are paying for these assets. So I think overall, we are seeing shareholders coming to understand the deal and even understanding the price, and certainly the independent valuation has supported that. But you're right, I mean, there's still a number of shareholders that I think are using the last opportunity they have to say, well, look, we don't support it, and we've got the last opportunity over the next few weeks to help convince those shareholders, and we've got to get 75% over the line. But these are quality assets, and they support what we think is a quality strategy. So, yeah, a bit of hard work to go for the next couple of weeks. We'll do our final roadshow over the next week or so.
Yeah, at least one shareholder is heavily invested in both yourselves and in Yamana Gold. It's an entity called FunEck. And FunEck, according to Canada's Globe and Mail, is a Yamana shareholder at nearly 6% and a shareholder in you at 10%, is questioning the logic of the deal. Now, this is somebody who knows, one assumes, as the biggest shareholder in both companies very well, and is saying this deal doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to tie these two things together.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce, clearly, we clearly disagree with that, because we have said to the market that you can see, both from a quality of asset perspective and also for a long-term strategy, it doesn't help that a company does nothing and just sort of waits until it gets itself into trouble. And it's both the board and the management's role to proactively look at what it should do. And if you can put two great companies together that have got complementary assets, we think there is a good strategy, both for Yamana shareholders, which we think in our combined company grow the value of what they have, and then also for the combination, we think, for Goldfield shareholders. So, yeah, we absolutely respect FunEck's point of view, but clearly we've got a different point of view, and I think many of our shareholders we hope to convince by the time the vote comes.
One of the concerns is that a big part of this business of Yamana Gold is exposed to Argentina. There's a guy called John Molloy, whose business Red Wheel says, Argentina is basically uninvestable. The currency market's a mess. The equity market's a mess. It's a high risk location. Companies can't get money out of Argentina. It seems like a fair observation of the current state of Argentina. You're looking beyond that?
Bruce, it's not the majority of the value that comes from a future project in Argentina. There certainly is a component of the value, but the deal is not being done on the premise that that project goes ahead. We think it is a great project in the fullness of time. We think we will invest in it. But before we put any meaningful amount of money into Argentina, you would have to tick the boxes that John from RWC is quoting. So we wouldn't put money into Argentina if we didn't think we could get money out. And so we don't think that the deal is premised on Argentina and that project. The deal is premised on great value that comes from the assets in South America, in Chile, Brazil, and also in Canada. So that's where the majority of the value comes from. There's a component of the value in Argentina. And if the worst came to the worst, you could probably sell that, given the recent transactions in Argentina, and make the money for which is attributed in our overall valuation to Argentina. So, yeah, we're not promising the market that we're going to rush out and go and do a big project development in Argentina. But it is a great project. It's been de-risked because it already has a plant in place. It's got tailings dams in place and all its logistics. So, relatively speaking, the capital spend will be quite light. But we would have to be able to tick those boxes with the government of Argentina before we invested any meaningful capital into that project. So we don't think there's actually the kind of risk that John is describing.
Okay. I mean, this is a very clear strategic intent. This is, you're saying, this is my strategy. This is what I, as chief executive, this is going to be my deal that's going to change the shape of Gold Fields into the future. And you make a compelling case as to why you would like to do it, and some of your shareholders are critical. What happens if you don't get across 75% and the deal does not happen? Does that mean that that's a rejection of you and your strategy, do you think? A vote of no confidence even?
Bruce, we don't think so. I mean, when we evaluated all the options available to us, I mean, we think that this is the best option, which is why we're doing, which is why we're promoting this to our shareholders, and why we're proactively investing in these, in this deal, so that by the time, 4 or 5 years from now, when our production starts declining, that we actually have solutions for that and actually have still ongoing options to grow the value of the company. But there are other options that we looked at. We just don't think they're as attractive as this one. But, on our target list, and even if we do acquire Yamana, there's still some assets out there that are attractive to us. So it's not, we don't have to jump off the balcony if this deal doesn't go through. There are other options available to Gold Fields, and from a position of strength, which is where we are now, in a very, very good position, there are still other options out there for us We think it'll be a shame if we don't chase down the very best option, but there are still other very good options available for us in the future if the Yamana deal doesn't go through.
Thank you, Chris Griffith, Chief Executive at Goldfields this evening. Not going to die on the slag heap of Yamana, not for a moment, but it is a deal that management is keen to do. Shareholders are critical. He's got 3 weeks to convince them that he's got a workable proposition. It's going to be interesting to see how this one plays out. We haven't had a big corporate deal like this for absolutely years, so it's exciting. It really is. Don't you wish we had a more pro-business government? Wouldn't it be nice if we had a pro-business government? One that made good regulation to ensure that the, I don't know, the green-eyed monster of corporate greed didn't subsume everything, but one that actively encouraged and embraced free enterprise as a mechanism for job creation and taxes. I mean, it's beyond my capacity as to why you would not want an economy that created jobs and generated more tax so that you could do more good things in your economy, and we could own the state bank, and you could have a national investment fund, all of these things. But just have a listen to this clip of audio I found today of the UK's Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. His name is Grant Shapps. Have a listen to this. It's called an elevator pitch. He'll explain.
You may have heard of an elevator pitch, using the few seconds you have in a lift to make your point. Well, here's mine for Bayes, using our famous round lifts. I'm going to champion the drivers of growth in the UK, supporting investment in science, business and innovation. Because governments don't pay for our public services, business, entrepreneurs and employees do. And I will, of course, ensure we fix the broken energy market, which is vital for our growth and reducing household bills. And that, in a nutshell, is my pitch as business secretary here at the Department for Growth.
Doors closing.
Isn't it marvellous? I mean, governments don't pay for public services. Businesses do. People do. Your taxes pay for public services. Government, we gotta pay this, we do this, we do that. You're rubbish. It's the taxes they collect out of enterprise that provide the money that makes that work possible. And I just love the way that he finishes. It's not the Department for Growth. It's the Department of, where is it? I scribbled it down. For Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. But his thinking is that it's the Department for Growth. That's so powerful. We've got trade and industry and competition, which I regrettably seems to get in the way more than enabling opportunities. But imagine having a properly resourced and powerful minister for growth. Oh, there'd definitely be something in that.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Have e-tolls actually been scrapped, or are they just going to come back as some sort of post-Halloween boogeyman? The chief executive at the organisation Undoing Tax Abuse is Wayne Devenage, who's led the charge against e-tolls and has been celebrating all week the fact that the term e-tolls have been scrapped. But there's still, these roads going to have to be paid for into the future somehow, Wayne. And I wonder if this is just a bit of governmental sleight of hand to get the problem of e-tolls off one balance sheet and onto another.
Yeah, Bruce. Yeah, look, I mean, ultimately, we, the public, as you were just saying in your previous piece, pay everything. It's not government. We will pay. So it's not like infrastructure falls out of the sky and bonds have been taken out and the government guaranteed. All that's happened is they've moved the expense away from trying to collect it from citizens through a very expensive and cumbersome and inefficient e-tolling system, which would never have worked, didn't work, taking funds from Treasury and so the province and all their money, also Treasury, had to settle these bonds. Had they done that, we'd have settled these bonds long ago.
Wayne, sorry, we need to get you into a better area. The cell phone signal is absolutely awful. Producers, please just chat to Wayne very quickly. It takes it from one section of government and puts it onto another section of government. It makes another section of government's problem, but it does take you off the payer principle, the user pays principle. But I'm still skeptical as to how the Gauteng government is going to wrap its head around this particular problem. Certainly, Tito Mboweni wants a refund because he went and paid $500 in outstanding e-toll since September, saying, I'm doing my duty. It's the right thing to do. It's quite sweet, actually. He's not being serious about it. He paid his bill and that's all well and good. But if you have paid your bills, you may feel desperately offended by the fact that others who have simply ignored paying the e-tolls have effectively got away with it. Let's catch up again with Wayne Devenage at Outer. Wayne, you were just talking about how you move the liability from one part of government to another, and then your phone line moved its liability from you to us.
Yeah, so all they've done is decided to not try and cover these bonds through a very expensive and inefficient tolling system, which would have sucked R1 billion out of the road users to settle those bonds. And this is what we told them to do. And now they're funding it through tax allocation. So we do ultimately pay, but we're going to pay a far more efficient way instead of wasting a third of the money to enrich international companies.
But the gantries were still built. The tech was still put into the system. Don't those bills still have to be paid? Because the idea was, of course, one of the reasons why the e-tolls were so infernally high was because these guys wanted their payback. Well, how are we going to deal with them?
Well, the gantries were about $3 billion out of the $21 billion that was borrowed. It was very unnecessary. The tech has been paid off. It was a 5-year contract that's gone, come and gone. So the tech is there, the gantries are there, and they are repurposing them, by the way, to introduce average speed over distance monitoring, traffic fines,
good.
Policing. So they are going to use that, and they're going to cover those costs, but they're not going to be able to use it to toll people or charge people to travel on the freeways anymore.
Okay, but the Gauteng government's budget is limited. They are. We just see e-tolls return in another guise, perhaps a year or two from now?
No, it can't, because electronic tolling is a drive now pay later scheme, very different to a boom down system where they won't lift the boom till you pay. This is a drive and we'll try and bill you through number plate recognition, and they've got a 15% hit rate on that. That's not a user pay scheme, so it's completely failed. So it's not going to happen. And Sanral have acknowledged they will never be able to introduce an electronic tolling system, not with the native system that is, not with the postal system the way it is. So that horse is bolted, but let's use the technology and try and put it to good use.
Thank you, Wayne Devenage. Our Money Show explained it this evening. Wayne Devenage, the chief executive at Outer, the organization undoing tax abuse. Wayne Devenage was once the head of Avis in South Africa, and he gave that up to do this job. And has been fighting tooth and nail. And of course, has got involved in many other campaigns and issues. But certainly this one will go down on his epitaph one day as a remarkable feat for the power of citizens over what they regard as draconian regulation, legislation and unfair fees.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Disappointing close to what was otherwise quite an exciting week on stock markets. Tato Mashego is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth on the line to us from Joburg this evening. Bit of a soggy end to an otherwise okay week, Tato, I thought.
Good evening, Bruce. I suppose it was a bit of a soggy end as you aptly described it. I think investors have been dissecting some of the economic data that's come out the past 2 days, and of course, weak tech earnings from the U.S. So a lot to consider from an inflation front, GDP front, and of course, corporate earnings.
China. Explain China to me, please. I'm having very severe doubts about China's efforts to equalize their own economy without breaking the rest of the global economy, because we've seen growth fall off a cliff in China. We've seen demand fall off a cliff in China. And today, I think it demonstrated that quite well with another sell-off in Naspers and Prosus, another sell-off in Richemont, and our resources counters, which are beginning to take a bit of China strain, I think.
Well, I think these days it's fair to say that when China starts sneezing, then the rest of the world as well is catching a cold. So it's no longer the U.S. that has that special privilege by itself. I think what's happening at the moment, of course, a few cities have announced some stringent lockdowns with regards to their zero-COVID policy. And what the government has stated is that they're going to continue along this path until the elderly vaccination rate matches the vaccination rate for the entire population. So unfortunately, the elderly in China are a bit hesitant to become vaccinated. So that rate is still somewhere around 87% compared to about 95% for the overall population. And of course, they're the most vulnerable and at risk. So until that situation changes, I think they seem adamant on continuing with their zero COVID policy. And of course, that impacts our commodity exports. It impacts Richmond and Nussberg as well. So we don't really have much that we can do right now except hope that this will be sorted out in the next few months.
Oh, we hope it is sorted out. Somebody posted a graph today of the MSCI China Index over 30 years. And over 30 years, it's flat. When it started 30 years ago, there was a sharp decline and it lost, lost half of its money. It lost about 50%. Since about 2002 or thereabouts, there's been just this steady growth in the China index all the way up, and really quite consistent and very nice growth going through all the way through to about 2019. And since then, China's fallen off a cliff, and all of the gains that have been made over 30 years have effectively been wiped out in the matter of the last 12 months.
Well, I suppose it depends on who you ask. Some would say, well, that is a sign that China is becoming increasingly uninvestable, whereas others would say it's a sign of a potential bargain for the coming decade. You are 100% correct. Of course, the technology shares have a large weighting in the MSCI China Index, and we know what's happened with the crackdown on the large internet companies in the past 2 years. So that goes some way to explaining the significant decline that we've seen and value destruction. Those who are a bit more optimistic would say, well, these companies such as Alibaba and Tencent are now trading at PE multiples of 10 times, which a few years ago they were both trading north of 30 times. They would argue, I suppose, that what we're seeing is more of a recession than a structural change, and that once zero COVID is sorted out and once the world recovers, you'll start seeing better consumer confidence and things will start to normalize. Whereas those who say, no, China is increasingly uninvestable are pointing, obviously, to some of the somewhat arbitrary actions being taken by the government. So I suppose investors have to choose if they see the glass half full or half empty.
Yeah, exactly. That is one part of it, of course. And when one looks then at other factors on the on global markets this week, a really big knock on American technology. Last night we had results out from Amazon and they got bashed down. And Meta, oh my goodness gracious me, it's Meta Bear. And the bear swiped down. And we've seen the huge declines in the value of some of the most rapid growth stocks of the last decade.
Well, perhaps they should have kept the name as Facebook and not Meta. I think it hasn't worked out too well for them. And unfortunately, Meta down about 70% year-to-date.
70?
It's only about 70, yes, 7-0. Tencent only down about 50%. So putting that in perspective, you can see how bad a year it's been for Meta and Facebook. Their results were obviously not well received at all. I think revenue was down about 4% year-on-year for the quarter. But of course, these growth stocks are priced for perfection and people expecting far more robust revenue growth. They've been spending a significant amount of money on their metaverse projects. And even the metaverse division saw its sales decline by 50%, just showing you how cyclical some of these ad revenue businesses can be. So very, very unfortunate quarter for Meta at the moment. Amazon faring a little bit better. Their share price down about 12% today. They issued a sales warning concerning the for the upcoming quarter, including the Christmas period, and as you know, Christmas being a major period for all retailers. So that tells you just how much strain people are under at the moment. And they mention inflation and obviously consumer confidence coming down a bit. So both of those large tech companies not doing too well at all. Whereas on the other side of things, companies like ExxonMobil just reported its best quarter ever in terms of profits, and $20 billion, believe it or not, in one quarter. So the pendulum has swung somewhat back to the old economy, away from the new economy.
It'll swing back eventually, one day. Tato Mashiko, thank you. Portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. I do love the fact that there is this vibrancy in markets. And some of the stuff that the tech companies do is illogical. And it's like trying to define the future and trying to do it now and trying to be, you know, predict the future and create the metaverse and participate in the metaverse. I couldn't think of anything worse. Couldn't think of anything more horrendous. The people have just responded to it going, nah. Get it right first, make it interesting, make it feel like something worthwhile, not just a game or yet another sort of virtual reality set or whatever the case might be. In the meantime, old world industries where we have demand for fossil fuels and energy, all the stuff that was so desperately unfashionable 18 months ago, is making the big bucks.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Trailblazing payment solutions to help you grow your business. The bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Friday file, we'll open it up, and I'm sure what will come out is a gentle mousse of bubbles and deliciousness. We'll talk to Stephen Seinfeld in a moment, who is the Joburg foodie, all about champagne in a bit. On the next Money Show, Robert Whitehead, consummate performer, creative developer of drama, both on stage and screen, joins us for Other People's Money. Looking forward to that. We'll talk about his relationship with money, how he saves, whether he can invest as an actor in South Africa. And then looking forward to this enormously, the Pieter du Toit, the award-winning journalist and author, the ANC billionaires, Big Capital's Gambit and the Rise of the Few. Fabulous brand new book next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
We're broadcasting live from the Absa Champagne Festival next week. It's happening at 6 p.m. on Wednesday at Inanda, and it's going to be so much fun. Today also happens to be Global Champagne Day. I didn't know that. Otherwise, I would have started with some. I wouldn't have got this far if I had. Stephen Seinfeld is the Joburg foodie on the line to us this evening. Please explain champagne. What is it about champagne that is so magical, that is so spectacular, that encompasses so much joy and happiness, Stephen?
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me on the show.
Please explain to me why champagne is the drink of choice for celebrations.
Sorry, I lost you there for a second. I think champagne is the wine with the ultimate story. You know, champagne has for hundreds and hundreds of years been a libation of celebration. And, I mean, even in Africa, you know, South Africa consumes the most champagne on the continent. And particularly demi-sec, which we tend to really love. But I think it is just because it's that light, it's that effervescence. It's got great acidity, so it's not too heavy. It just is. It's the perfect drink for all the time.
What was it? The Dom Perignon, who's supposed to be the monk who accidentally created champagne, took a sip of this bubbly wine and said, "I've tasted the stars." I mean, that's the legend anyway.
100%. Yeah, there are a number of great figures through champagne history. And as I say, I think, you know, especially in today's world, that everything is better with a story. And I don't think there is a wine with a better story than champagne.
Talk to me about the copies. Everywhere in the world, people try to make copies. You've got Cava in Spain. You've got Prosecco in Italy. You've got Cap Classique in South Africa. And every region that produces wine uses the champagne method of making sparkling wine instead of just making wine and putting gas in it. They actually, you know, allow natural fermentation to create the bubbles. The copies, certainly in South Africa, I think we've got some remarkable copies that outstrip the mainstream Moët's, Verve's and others that we get on our bottle store shelves.
Yeah, so essentially champagne is a region, and to be called champagne, you have to be made in that region, but it is the method, traditional method of making sparkling wine that is unique to, you know, champagne production. And, you know, only 50 years ago in South Africa did Simintsch start making our what we now know as Cab Classique here. But there are, as you say, numerous copies around the world. Prosecco is actually made in a slightly different style to champagne. It is carbonated in vat. But yeah, the champagne has to come from champagne if you want to call it champagne.
But our own Cab Classique, it stands up well, doesn't it? I mean, there's good Cab Classique and there's less good Cab Classique, but there are some incredibly good examples at a much more less challenging price point that actually box above their weight versus some of the French stuff.
We're making incredible Cab Classiques here, and I think there are incredible, you know, Cab Classique producers. Again, I think it comes down to legacy, and we're getting there. But as I say, we've only had 50 years of making Cab Classique. It beats the few hundred years that the French have ahead of us.
You talk about the Champagne region as being relatively small, and I don't know if you know the acreage off by heart or the number of hectares, but it is a relatively small patch of earth, which I think is very actively and aggressively farmed in order to meet global demand for champagne, which has skyrocketed in recent years. I wonder just what happens to champagne production into the future, because you can't make more land in Champagne unless you start growing grapes vertically or something to maximize yields.
Bruce, you're absolutely correct there, and we're actually seeing it throughout the markets, is that there has been quite a shortage of champagne. As I mentioned, South Africa, we are the leaders in Africa in terms of champagne consumption. I think last year we hit the over a million bottle mark. And yeah, it becomes really difficult when you have to rely on vintage, as some champagnes do. When you're working with non-vintage champagnes and you can pull from reserve wine, it obviously allows you to increase the amount you're producing. But at the end of the day, yeah, there is only a certain amount of champagne that can be made. So meeting global demand is going to be an interesting factor in coming years, as will global warming, which, you know, it's changing how we grow wine and where we grow wine.
Absolutely. I think even the English are producing something. I don't know what they call it, but it's got bubbles in it. I'm not sure if it was on purpose either. You're at the Mount Nelson this evening in Cape Town, where they are celebrating Global Champagne Day. Have you tasted anything decent today?
Yeah, so we are here with Moët & Chandon. Every year they host a Champagne Day celebration, and this year it is happening at the Belmont Mount Nelson. So yeah, we've been drinking a lot of Moët & Chandon.
Oh, okay, so you don't get variety, but you get quality, which is fine.
You get quality. But yeah, there have been quite a few outstanding producers down. As I mentioned, champagne being quite, South Africa being quite an important market for champagne. In the past, you know, 2 weeks, I think I've met winemakers from Moët & Chandon, Vertrico, Drapier, Philipponat. It's really interesting to see the champagne interest in South Africa. And I think it's definitely speaks to our markets, you know, consumption and the demand for more.
Well, we're at the APSA Champagne Festival on Wednesday next week. What should I be looking out for?
Oh, you're putting me in a tough spot here.
On the spot.
Yeah, I think that it will be interesting to see who does have stock at the Champagne Festival. I actually haven't taken a look and seen who will be there, but I would go for grower champagne. So grower champagnes are the type of champagnes you wouldn't normally find on shelf. They're more the types that are, as the name suggests, they're made by the people who grow the grapes. So there's much smaller boutique type of champagne producers, and there usually are quite a few of them at the Champagne Festival. So, yeah, go look for some grower champagnes. I think that will be quite cool.
Producers, you've been given your task by Stephen Steinfeld. Stephen is the Joburg foodie at the Belmont Mount Nelson this evening, celebrating World Champagne Day. No doubt he's going to go back inside and have another little sip. We will be at the APSA Champagne Festival on Wednesday night. I think it's going to be a huge amount of fun. No doubt Michael Fridgen will be there, and the producers will be there. And we will give you the best possible perspective on champagne. And yes, it's a huge luxury. That's why it makes it into the Friday file. But it's interesting that South Africa is Africa's biggest consumer. 1 million bottles of champagne. That excludes Cab Classique, by the way. 1 million bottles of champagne consumed in South Africa last year. How many of those did you consume, I wonder? Easy start to the Brutal Biz Quiz for you this evening. I'd like you to join us and play tonight on 021 446-0567 011-883-0702. Come and play the Brutal Biz Quiz tonight, and you can have bragging rights on being the reigning champion, the reigning whiz of the Biz Quiz. You can make T-shirts, you can get pom-poms printed, you can do whatever you like just for the next week if you are successful. From which company did champagne originate? Champagne comes from one part of the world. It originated in that part of the world. Which part of the world is it? Name the country. 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Give us a call this evening and play the Brutal Biz Quiz here on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
From which country did champagne originate? In Braamfontein, we got Sikumbuzo. Sikumbuzo, where did champagne come from?
It comes from the country of France, from the region of Champagne.
Very good, Sikumbuzo. Very good, indeed. How many prime ministers has the UK had this year? What number prime minister is it on?
Can you repeat the question?
How many prime ministers has the UK had this year? It's on... Prime Minister number what for the year?
It was Prime Minister number 6.
No, it's crazy. They're wild over there. They're mad over there. It's not that bad. Ricardo in Cape Town, they're on Prime Minister number what in the United Kingdom this week? This
year? That would be Prime Minister number... Fourth Prime Minister.
Again, Ricardo. I mean, I know it sounds worse than it probably is, but no, not four. Mughal, how many have they had?
Three
is correct. They've had two. They're actually on number three. Rishi Sunak is the third prime minister in a year, following Liz Truss's little intervention and Boris Johnson getting booted out earlier on this year. Please name the company that is responsible for managing, maintaining and developing our national roads. What is the name of that company?
Sanrail?
Pardon?
Sanrail?
Sanrail, absolutely right. Sanrail, your line's not great, but the South African National Roads Agency Limited. Inokorongwana, the finance minister, finally dropping the curse of the e-tolls and passing that problem onto the Gauteng government. Who is calling themselves Chief Twit as of today?
Elon Musk.
Elon Musk is the chief twit. Absolutely right. Elon Musk is indeed the chief twit. Twitter stocks are being delisted from the New York Stock Exchange today after Elon Musk finally managed to get through the deal. $44 billion, a deal that he first wanted, then didn't want, then claimed he didn't want. It was actually quite Jacob Zuma about his approach to Twitter, but eventually was forced to take it. In which year did the JSE suspend Tongaat Hulett from trading on the stock exchange? Was it this year? Was it last year? Or was it as far back as 2019?
Last year.
It wasn't last year. I know it's been a long year, Mohal, but it wasn't. Mill in Pretoria?
2019.
I'm afraid they weren't that efficient. No. So let's say you've only got one option. Was it this year, last year, or 2019? We've had last year and 2019 already. So when was it, let's say?
Bruce, I didn't hear your question.
Just say this year, let's say. Let's get it over and done. We'll say this year.
2022?
Yes, there we go. You don't even hear the question and you know the answer. Yes, Tongaat Hulett was suspended from trade on the JSE in 2022. Name at least one company that has cut ties recently with that very strange man, Kanye West.
Sports company, is it Reebok or Adidas? Reebok.
Pick one and then stick with one, let's say.
Adidas.
Adidas is correct. Absolutely right. Vogue has cut ties with him. Gap has cut ties with him. And Adidas this week finally cutting ties with him as well. His anti-Semitism has finally caught up with him. Nick Johnson. His interview is going to be in the best bits of The Money Show in just a bit. He was our shapeshifter this week. He's the chief executive of which workwear company?
Johnson Workwear.
I love the way you've connected the dots on that one, let's say. You've got bragging rights. You can brag. You can go and shout it from rooftops. You can go to whatever building you're in at the moment, go and stand on the roof and say, I am the whiz of the biz quiz. And people will come from miles around and just pay tribute to you and tell you that you're a genius. Nick Johnson, chief executive at Johnson Workwear, was our shapeshifter this week. He shared with us how it started, and it's an incredibly wonderful, humble, glorious story. And he's quite uncomfortable about his success in some ways. I mean, he's very proud of his success, but I think he's also like, I don't want to brag. Brag away, Mr. Johnson. Brag away, Nick. And he sells products to 20 countries. He's got operations in Lesotho, South Africa, Australia, the UK. And Johnson Workwear is a thing. And I just thought it was like EFF overalls and stuff. But they make real clothes too, like really nice stuff, golf shirts and things, and wimpy and uniforms and stuff that people wear and feel really proud to wear, your corporate ID stuff. It's really, really good stuff. So it's a lovely interview, and you'll be astounded if you didn't hear it on Wednesday, just how much studying and how much slog he put into his MBA, which he never did. And just what he thinks about education. And it's a really lovely shapeshifter discussion and is part of tonight's Best Bits. That's coming up between 7 and 8 here on The Money Show.